Thank you, Rhonda and Dennis and Joe and company for inviting me back again to one of the things about community I really enjoy, and that's debate. Debate and dialogue. And and to share in a dialogue with you fantastic people is terrific. And I just wanted to pay my tribute to our community for the great 2 days they've organised for us. Thank you, Rhonda, and thank you, team. And, of course, not to forget Centrecare, because even though Joe barracks for Richmond and was duly defeated by a better team in red and black recently, he's a major partner. And I understand, Walid, you actually barrack for Richmond too. Sorry about that, but not about the win. Can I ask our debaters to come up to the stage? I'll introduce them as they go to speak, but I'll ask them all to come up to the stage because it's a bit lonely up here. It reminds me of being Premier. Anne Dunn, well known as Madame Rose. Thank God it's not a spotted dress. Oh, yeah. You could have at least done it with the stockings. Thank you. And secondly, Walid Ali, who is the leader on multicultural issues, spokesman for Islam Council. Walid. And next is John Roscombe, who's the Executive Director of the Institute of Public Affairs. This is a historic moment. It's the first time I've sat on the same side as John.
But it's on the right.
First on the right. You're further right than me, though. And last but not least, Karen Welch, the president of QCOS, the Queensland Council of Social Services. I forgot to tell you what Anne does. Anne, you can't actually describe what Anne does. I was told by one of her fellow country women this morning that whatever Anne says, it'll be inspirational. She didn't actually tell me that whatever Anne dressed in would be inspirational. But Anne has been associated with inspiring and empowering women and communities for a long time, particularly rural communities, arts communities, and she is currently chair of the Australian Government's Regional Women's Advisory Council. So, how we're going to run this is normal debate rules with a bit of humour thrown in. Each speaker will speak for 10 minutes, and then there'll be a summing up by one, or they might share the summing up at the end. They'll be strictly on 10 minutes, though. Even though our communities are good organisers, they did forget to give me a bell. Now, has anybody got a bell in the audience? What's the matter with you? I thought community organisations had everything. Anyway, I'll use the old glass trip. You can decide whether the glass is half full or half empty. I've got the pleasure of introducing this debate, and I have to say I was rapt with the topic. Elected government, federal, state and local, should decide on community priorities because the only place to influence policy is through elections.
Ladies and gentlemen, despite the biased introduction by your chair to this topic, my colleague Walid and I have taken it very seriously. In the interests of fair play, mateship, and those other Australian values, we ask you to suspend your judgment about your entire life's work for the next half an hour or so, and to consider the arguments that we present to you. The Bolshe proposition that, as presented, asks you to consider who should decide on community priorities and suggests that the community should voice its view on policy through casting their vote and then trust the elected governments to make the best decisions on behalf of the whole community. An admirable proposition, if I might say so. Now, I'm in a unique position to enlighten you on this matter, and I want you to take my credentials to your heart. I'm on the streets of St Kilda every day, so I know what people want, and I entertain quite a lot of politicians at night. So I know what are their strengths and weaknesses. What is clear to me is that community priorities cannot be left to the community, who are completely driven by self-interest. To get the best for the whole community, we need to put ourselves in the hands of people who have a higher view, who have a clear picture from the clouds on which they sit of what will be best for all of us. Who better to rely on than those marvellous men and women who put their lives on hold, suffer great stress under huge workloads, and risk their life and reputation for public interest? Now, I know, because I've been listening to some of you on the streets of St Kilda, I know that some of you have been wavering in recent years about the intentions and interests of our politicians. And I regret to say that many young people in the street are growing up with a complete lack of respect for our leaders. This is our fault. We've set a very bad example. We've set a bad example by complaining about the private lives of politicians. And I must say, I think most of them need a couple of private lives just to stay sane. We complain endlessly and grizzle endlessly about their pay and conditions. The poor things, they haven't got a union or even an AWA. And we doubt their motives. These are people who sacrifice their lives for us, yet we're breeding a generation of cynics in our young people. And have you considered where this might end? Frankly, if we're to end up without revered government, and we end up in a state of anarchy, I'm not happy about putting my future into the hands of young people with the attention span of a gnat, who are more interested in surfing than working. I've been a working girl all my adult life. And I think the future of this country is dependent on all of us agreeing to work. Well, at least almost every day. So here we all are, each pursuing our own interests. Some of those interests more productive than others, but nonetheless, we're pursuing our own interests. And we might seriously be suggesting that we self-interested beings should be allowed to set community priorities. Let's look at some of those priorities. A large percentage of the population are not interested in having children. In the last 30 years, the number of single-person households in Australia rose from 19 to 28%. Rather, people seek to pursue their own selfish happiness, a life priority that will lead to the extinction of the human race. What about this priority? Most of the adult male population places a priority on cars, and fast ones at that. While it's quite clear to us that the survival of the very air we breathe and the environment that we live in will be dependent on us giving away our cars. This priority on cars will certainly lead to the extinction of the planet on which we live. So people gone, planet gone. Let me talk about water for a bit. The community places a priority on farmers using less water. Terrible, those farmers. They're so wasteful out there with that precious stuff, while the people in the cities have to live with restrictions and are so responsible with the way they use water. However, the complainants fail to recognise that every glass of Chardonnay they drink has taken a precious 15 litres of water to produce. Every 8-ounce steak they lovingly consume has taken 5,000 litres of water, and every slice of white bread, 28 litres. Don't think the vegetarians are pure either. Every cup of lettuce takes 11 litres of water. 1 kilo of soya beans, 2,000 litres. And 1 kilo of dry wheat, 750 litres. Community priorities would cut water allocation to farmers so that in the end we had nothing to eat or drink. How useless is that? Then there's our obsession with contact sport. What sort of priority is that? Contact that's violent, aggressive, creates heroes of people who are the most violent and the most aggressive. What about a bit more of priority on loving and what different form of human contact? I'd support a bigger priority on that. The community's placed a priority on home ownership, and look where that's led us. Now in Sydney, it takes an average of $500,000 to buy a dumpy, small suburban house, impossible on an income of $50,000 a year. No money for food, for clothes, for family outings or extracurricular activities. And a girl like me is supposed to have a living. This priority has resulted in families being forced to have at least two incomes just to survive. So there you go. When you really look at it, you can see that the community priorities cannot be set by the community. These priorities can only safely be in the hands of people who see the bigger picture. The community has an exciting opportunity every few years to tell politicians what they want, vote for the people who promise to give it to them, and then sit back and have safe, healthy, happy communities delivered to them through sensible policies from our politicians at all levels. What more could you want? It's time we became respectful of our governments and taught our children to follow us in this. We cannot become a nation of knockers and yobbos with no real leaders. This debate is really about values, mateship, fair go for all, respect for each other and pride in our leadership. So when I come back, I'll ask you to join me in an expression of pride for our leadership.
Rhonda said to Karen and I 5 minutes ago, or before the debate started, be funny. So we struggled with being funny, but I reckon it's pretty funny that Rhonda has asked me to follow someone wearing red feathers in this debate. You know, the only funny line that I know about government is the one about, and I'm here to help. Joan actually probably won't remember this, but we spoke, Joan and I, in October 1992, and it was probably about October 6 or October 7 or October 8. And I remember it pretty vividly because we'd just come into government and we received a phone call, and I took the call from the former Premier of Victoria. The Kennett government had just been sworn in a few days earlier, and the former Premier was ringing the Education Minister because she was aware that over the weekend some school relocatables had burnt down. The school wasn't even in her electorate, and she was just ringing to make sure that in the transition to government, we made sure that the department quickly dealt with this issue. And I must say, it always impressed me that even though Joan had left government then, she didn't stop caring. So it's an honour to be here at this debate being chaired by Joan. What Karen and I are going to talk to you about is the fact that government can't be trusted, most of the time gets it wrong, and usually has no idea what it's doing. If we are talking about only allowing elected officials to decide our priorities, as Joan said, right now most of us can go home. Fortunately, none of us believe it. I'm, by and large, a believer in democracy. By and large, I think the Australian people get it pretty right when they make their decisions. I, by and large, think that the Australian people have a great degree of common sense, unless they're unlucky enough to barrack for Collingwood. But not even Eddie Maguire has all of the abilities that we now demand from our public servants. What government relies upon is all of us making decisions. There's no such thing as government making decisions, as government decisions. Ultimately, these are decisions of ourselves and of our communities and of the groups that we work with and our families and of civil society. The vote once every 3 or 4 years is merely a shallow reflection of the myriad of things we do every day. I mean, if we look at how governments determine priorities in reality, we'd know the sham of most government decision making. You know, many of us have been involved in government and we know you never appoint a committee unless you know the answer first. If you don't get the answer that you want, then you try, and try again. If you don't get the answer you want, then you haven't been doing your job properly. In the good old days, there used to be a great degree of debate in federal government, and many of you would remember the old-fashioned model of governments at the federal level issuing green papers, which were the big radical reform proposals, and then after a period of consultation there would be the white paper, which was the government publishing its final decisions. After a while, most people realised what a joke this was, and there emerged a form of humour which talked about how do you turn a green paper into a white paper? Well, actually, you simply photocopy it. Once upon a time, government was easy. Or, you know, certainly government was easier than it is now. The great reform challenges of the 70s and 80s in the economic field were things that governments and ministers and advisors and public services could handle. The floating of the dollar, tariff reform, changes to the banking system were simply most of the time made by decision of a stroke of a pen. But now, the big social, educational, health, welfare issues that we struggle with every day don't have one simple answer. They have a myriad of answers, and not one single one of us knows the answer to every problem. But we expect government to have the answers, and quite frankly, government doesn't have the answers. The answers rest with us. Government is good at doing lots of things, but government is not good at handling diversity. Government is not good at handling difference. In a nursing home, when people say they would rather be served dinner at 6:30 rather than 5 o'clock, most of the time the system can't handle it. Turn that into a system with tens of thousands of people into a model, and we see the model breaks down. Governments can't handle risk, and the big issues of the future will deal with risk. Governments can't handle controversy, and they certainly can't handle peasants revolting. I was fortunate enough to be at a housing commission estate a few weeks ago, and I had an incident of an example of how government doesn't like risk. There was a tenants' union that had a grant of a couple of $100s, and of course, is there anyone from DHS here? Probably most of you. Anyway, I won't tell you where it was, and that government grant of a couple of $100s was audited by a Big Four accounting firm at a cost of at least $4,000. That's what government does. And I'm old-fashioned. If we're talking about who we'd rather have to spend the money and decide on the priorities, I'd rather it was us other than the government. The IPA last year published a major discussion paper on reforms to mental illness services and physical disability services. As that paper revealed, over the last 10 years, spending on those services at the federal and state level has increased by more than $3 billion, more than 70%. As we know, dramatic improvements in funding for key social policy issues. But if government thought these issues were as important as we all do, why are no outcomes measured? Why is there no knowledge of the value for money that we're getting, spending this huge amount of money and providing services for the most disadvantaged people in our community? So what I've presented is what government actually does, what government is, and the weaknesses of government. What we have to decide in this debate, when you come to vote, is whether or not you're going to rely on the life decisions for ourselves and for the people we care for, whether those decisions are going to be made by people in Spring Street and people in Canberra, or whether they're going to be made by us ourselves. And Karen and I believe that that decision is too important to be left to anyone other than ourselves.
I can't escape the feeling that our side of this debate's a little bit outnumbered. And I also can't escape the feeling there's something symbolic in the fact that the adjudicator is standing on the other side of the stage. If an autographed copy of a book will change anything, then Joan, I'm... In fact, I know it's your birthday soon, isn't it, Joan? There's something last year about that. Those who are here might remember it. But I won't sing anything to you. I just thought I'd say happy birthday. I guess there's some irony in the fact that I'm standing here arguing for the affirmative as someone who is widely seen as the representative of a community organisation or indeed an entire community. What that means is that I am speaking here today against self-interest. And that means I must be right. Should be enough to decide the debate, really, but I'll... You give a lawyer 10 minutes, you're going to get 10 minutes, so I'll keep going. The reason I can stand here and argue against self-interest is that this debate is not really about communities at all. You might think that. It's at a communities conference, mentions the word community in the title. All of these things are distractions. Do not be fooled. This is really a debate, like everything else in politics, this is really a debate about Australian values. And Australian values like secularism, like the free market, these are all uniquely Australian things, I'm sure you'll agree. But most of all, about democracy. I was outraged to hear John Ruscombe argue that he's actually someone who defends and cares about democracy. If that's the case, he'd be sitting over this side of the stage. The fact is, there is only one democratic outcome to this debate, and that is a vote for us. And I'll explain why. But that, I want to get clear at the outset, that is exactly what's at stake here. It's not my pride. I don't need you to vote for me to make me feel good. I need you to vote for me to make you feel good. Democracy, Australian democracy, is at stake today. What is under threat here is this this fundamental principle that belies every democracy in the world, and Australian democracy, I think, more than any other, and that is the belief in the pure wisdom of the elected. In the introduction, Joan had some things to say about wisdom, and she said that government has wisdom and people have wisdom, and that's true. People, you have wisdom. You managed to get yourselves here today. That involved a certain degree of wisdom. Congratulations, well done. But there are people who have greater wisdom, and they are the people that we vote into power. You see, because they have the wisdom of all of us combined. Everybody puts in their vote, and you end up with this product. And if you subscribe to the theory, which I think is beyond doubt, that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, then the wisdom of our elected officials is unimpeachable. And I think you should reflect on that before you cast your vote today. Because if you consider voting for the other side, what you're in fact doing is exercising the deficiency in your wisdom. But this principle that the elected have an unimpeachable wisdom is under threat at the moment in ways that we've never seen before in this country. The recent push in every state, and obviously as a federal campaign, for the introduction of a Human Rights Act or a Bill of Rights is perhaps one of the most disgusting developments in Australian political life, because what it does is it says that we're going to take power away from elected representatives and give them to other people who we think might have wisdom, such as judges, so on, people like that. And this is a problem, because if we start to doubt the wisdom of the elected, we prevent them from being able to do very, very important things, such as, you know, torture people in the search for information. It's very, very important that they have the power to do this where necessary. They're sensible people. They exercise the wisdom of all of us. At least I think that's right. But what we have to do, given this sustained attack, is that we have to reassert this principle. We have to reassert the wisdom of the elected, because without of it, we lose democracy. Without of it, we may as well just turf democracy, decide who it is that has wisdom, and make them governments for life. We should know. I know all about that. My family's from Egypt. This is the way in which society should develop. And this really begins with considering the relationship of government to communities. What we have to do is figure out how we're going to calibrate that relationship in a way that preserves Australian values. And the two values I want to talk about here, obviously, are tolerance and democracy. How do we deal with the uppityness of community groups while being tolerant of that, while at the same time defending our democracy? And I think that the fact that we are tolerant is reflected in the fact that we need to strike a middle path here. Let's not be extreme about this. So community groups, I think, should still be allowed to exist. We shouldn't outlaw them. But we have to balance that with democracy. And so the democratic solution is that we must treat more favourably those who don't disagree with elected representatives. Because they are the only community groups that are not engaged in some kind of shameless attack on the will of the Australian people. So what governments, I think, need to do, in accordance with Australian values, and particularly in accordance with the mechanisms of the free market that we hold so dearly, we can't just ban these groups. So what we need to do is instead incentivise. And I think that's fairly easy to do. We fund those groups that deserve it, and we tax those groups that don't. It's not a difficult equation. I'm just about to finish, Dan. It's okay. Because I think that those who insist on lobbying government, or at least putting forward arguments that are different to those of government, deserve attacks, really. Why should the government be rewarding those who are attacking the Australian people? Our fashionably totalitarian opponents on the very far left of the stage are in fact putting forward a proposition that would demolish democracy. We put forward one that would nurture it by silencing those who would oppose the wisdom of the Australian people. That doesn't mean that we limit people's say.
You're getting away with reverse discrimination.
This is what you get when you have a totalitarian chair.
I'm going to take a different tack in probably addressing that what we think as a democracy should be by the ability to actually look at a few different arguments and a few different points of view and actually come to believe that we as a people can have politicians that could act on compromise rather than the raw power of simply being in government. And I'm speaking against the proposition that politicians should have the legitimacy to set community priorities because of a number of reasons. One, they don't represent who the community is, and nor are they in touch with the lived realities of the people and the diversity and the history of this country. When I went to look at the Constitution, I thought I might get some inspiration for today about what's the mission statement that our politicians worked for, what are the values and beliefs and the rights and the principles that our politicians are safeguarding, including the right to maintain a democracy, the right to hear what different people believe in, the experiences that have oppressed people or believing in the Indigenous people of our land, giving them the rights to be valued and respected for the first people of the land. And there are no such words in the Constitution. So the first reason why I'm against simply letting our vote determine who sets the priorities is that we as a country don't have a statement that we can hold them accountable to. We don't have a statement in a constitution that says these are the principles that we believe inform a civil society and a democratic society. So we can't leave it to the politicians so that we just vote and then they take over. Often when we're preparing to go and see politicians in Queensland, we're told they read nothing, they don't listen, they'll be talking to you about what they're doing. You've got to put everything in concise, three dot points. In one event when we were talking about, we wanted to see the government address a whole of government approach to poverty. We were told, well, you know, you have to get it in three dot points. So why would any of us want to reduce ourselves to a point of view in three dot points and leave the politicians to decide those priorities? Often the issues that we come up against and the information that politicians need to set priorities is hidden amongst the power of the marketplace. It's hidden behind the power of who is elected, and it's also hidden by the power of who we are as a community sector. If we continue to follow the path that politicians have to set these priorities, then we're going to continue to experience the perception and the reality of people's voices being silenced. And that means that whilst we feel silenced, the people who come to our organisations, the people we engage with all the time, won't have a voice. It is our right to actually represent the minority. It is our right to represent our own issues in communities and neighbourhoods. But if we leave it to politicians, then it becomes the politicians' right to gather the information, to gather the views, to have a public sector that gives them the information that they need to set priorities, and we're excluded. And more importantly, the people that we're engaged with are excluded. Part of the role that we as a not-for-profit sector, as communities who want to have control, is to bridge those gaps in a democracy. And we can't bridge those gaps if we only leave it to when we vote. We have to somehow bring into our own understanding the humanity and the reality of people who are dismissed. We have a shameful history with the Indigenous community. We have a shameful history with the institutionalisation and the harm that it's done for children, for people with a disability and mental illness. If we continue to say it's only our vote that is going to set the priorities, then how are those people ever going to get their voices heard? How are they ever going to challenge us to progress, to really look beyond reason, to look beyond what is just popular for the day, to look beyond what has made our life prosperous or the benefits that we receive in a community, and really look at how people have missed out? Politicians, as Kay said to us, are only people too. And I think as a democracy, limiting it to the vote is not enough. We really have to bring together the different groups to talk to each other as we do, and we really have to bring together the most marginalised to speak with the politicians so that we can set new agendas and we can have the vision of a just and a democratic society.
Now, an oxymoron is a contradictory statement. And we've heard a lot of contradictory statements from the affirmative today. Examples of oxymorons are things like, you know, military intelligence, a compassionate lawyer, an honest politician. Sorry, Joan. But of course, the granddaddy of them all today is the one that the affirmative would have you believe, but which is wrong. The wisdom of government. Now, we don't have to speculate about the sort of world that we would live in if the affirmative team got their way. We live in that sort of world right now. Because, you know, the logical conclusion of what the affirmative is saying is, if you're not going to give power to the community and all of us, and you're going to hand power to the politicians, why stop at the group of politicians? Why not just hand power, untrammelled authority, to one person? Now, we have an example of that. We have in this country someone who's been in the job a long time. Someone who's not getting any younger. Someone who has suppressed any internal rebellion. Someone who's had some good victories but is facing difficult times and could be staring defeat in the face. If you decide to vote for the affirmative today, you will be deciding to renew Kevin Sheedy's contract. Don't do it!
I think the main reason that we have to vote against the affirmative of limiting our role to the vote is that if we do, we will be participating in the continuing death and demise of democracy in our country. We are led to believe that democracy will die from an act of terror, but it is really, as a quote from Robert Hillman said, the slow extinction from apathy, indifference and undernourishment. I think that we have to vote against and believe in our own power as advocates for communities in control, that our challenge is not to limit ourselves to our vote, but to be the alternative to apathy through active participation, the alternative to indifference, to be well-informed debate and to participate and create that debate, and to be the alternative to undernourishment so that we can continue to nourish and advocate ourselves and our communities so that all Australians can participate in the social and economic well-being of the country.
Now, look, ladies and gentlemen, let's be clear. There are only two really important things for you to keep in your mind. The first is self-interest, clearly laid out by my colleague, Waleed. We are ordinary people from the street. We have no self-interest in this particular debate, whereas these people over here represent organisations the very future and livelihood of is dependent upon them winning this debate. They argue from self-interest, and we argue from self-righteousness. And secondly, I want to raise with you the question of values. It is about values. Do not be misled by them. Mateship, fair go for all, respect for each other, democracy and pride in our leaders. Pride for us and pride that we can hand on to our children. So I'll get you to join with me, just experience this. You weren't very good actually in the last session when you tried to do this, but I know you'll be fantastic this time. So just kind of let go with sort of full voice and see how you feel at the end of it. So I wonder if we might have... bring back, oh bring back our values to you and me. Polis, polis will shepherd our community. Australia is courting disaster. We're facing a catastrophe. We think that the people know better than the leaders of democracy. Bring back, oh bring back our values to you and me. Polis, polis will shepherd our community. As people we are easygoing. Relax, we treat life as a breeze. So let's give our polis a challenge to meet all our priorities. Keep going, there's more. Bring back, oh bring back our values to you and me. Polis, polis will shepherd our community. The poor and the weak and the homeless rely on our politicians to make sure their needs are considered, not passed in the life auction. Polly's calling back, oh, bring back our values to you and me. Polly's, Polly's. One more. It's time to stand up and be counted. Get Polly's that will not be cursed, so we can sit back till elections and know that our wishes come first. All together, bring back, oh, bring back our values to you and me. Polly's, Polly's will shepherd our community.
I wonder if she offers more value down in St Kilda. Bit of fading in and out there. Well, that's the beginning of the debate. It's a debate that we're all involved in almost every day. It's a debate that we need to be involved in because somewhere between these extreme points of view and well thought out and beautifully argued and humorfully argued points of view is the future society, a society that moves forward with all its people. So please, can you thank all the contributors? Karen, John, Waleed, and Anne. And now the big moment. We got the prezzies, the prizes, yes. All, careful, now just concentrate. I'm going to call for the vote for the affirmative. That's Rose's and Waleed's team first. All those in favour of the affirmative team winning.
Come on!
Thank you. All those in favour of the negative team winning. Can we have people standing in their places, please? All those who favour the affirmative team winning, please stand and don't move. Thank you. Please sit down. That's according to Father Joe Caddy. That was 370. All those, I think he's a betting man. All those in favour of the negative winning team winning, please stand. 371. Thank you, everybody.